I'm going to go ahead and share a screen. Actually, hold that thought. I'm going to open this. Start a presentation. Now I'll share the screen. All right, hopefully you all can see that. Let me know if you can't. Over the course of the last year or so, we've been studying worship in the age to come. And we've looked at the reinstitution of many aspects of worship seen previously under the Mosaic Law, albeit in a slightly different form during the Kingdom Age, for the purpose of providing a means of teaching and worship for both the inhabitants of the land, the restored tribes of Israel, as well as those who remain of the nations of the earth. We looked at the various sacrifices and feasts that will be reinstituted, as described throughout the prophets, as well as more recently, the hierarchical makeup of the future priesthood. We noted that Christ will reign as the king priest after the order of Melchizedek, his saints, the immortal sons of Zadok, and who will work within the most holy place and approach unto Yahweh at the altar, and also the immortal natural Levites performing the general service of the future temple for the mortal population, including ministering to and being the keepers of the house and all the service thereof, which comprises accepting and slaying the burnt offerings and sacrifices for the people, having charge at the gates of the house, and standing before the people to minister unto them, so some level of teaching and judgment. Considering this future house of prayer is for all people of the earth to come and worship Yahweh, with all nations coming from year to year to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, it would be expected that this place of worship would be of enormous size. Consider how much activity will be involved in the future temple in order to simply process the offerings and sacrifices brought by all nations of the earth, even if such activities were spread out throughout the year. And indeed, this is what we find with Ezekiel's first description of the temple that he saw. So let's start by looking at Ezekiel 40, 1 through 4. I get the slides going here. Ezekiel chapter 40, 1 through 4. In the 25th year of our captivity, in the beginning of our year of the year, in the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after that the city was smitten, in the selfsame day the hand of Yahweh was upon me and brought me thither. In the visions of God brought he me into the land of Israel, and set me upon a very high mountain, by which was as the frame of a city on the south. And he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man, whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, and a line of flax in his hand, and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate. And the man said unto me, Son of man, behold with thine eyes, and hear with thine ears, and set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee, for to the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. Here the temple is described at a distance as the frame of a city on the south. The word frame there is mibna, meaning a building or frame, and the word city is ayar, meaning a city in the widest sense, an encampment or court. While this structure is later revealed to be a temple of worship and not a city per se, its size and structure appeared to Ezekiel as the form or frame of a city. Most cities that Ezekiel would have been familiar with in his time would have had strong outer walls creating a perimeter, and additional walls on the interior forming separate districts, typically with a palace or temple of some sort in the middle. So certainly we can see how this temple structure would be perceived as a city from a long ways off. Next, Ezekiel is brought close to the structure and sees a man whose appearance was like the appearance of brass. Who is this man, or who is he representative of? We find that brass throughout Scripture is associated with sin. And in particular, polished, burnished, or fine brass are associated with those who have overcome sin. Consider the brazen serpent lifted up in the wilderness in Numbers 21, which the Israelites looked to in order to be saved from the bites of the fiery serpents sent among them due to their loathing of Yahweh's provisions. Jesus identifies himself as the antitypical brazen serpent in John 3, 14 and 15. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have eternal life. This, of course, referring to his coming sacrifice and victory over sin, which opens the way of salvation to all mankind. And we'll touch more on this during the memorial service. Further, Ezekiel had already seen a similar display in the cherubim of chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. And every one, that is, every one of the four living creatures that he saw, had four faces, and every one had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled or shined like the color of burnished brass. Likewise, Daniel and John received visions of the man of the one and the apocalyptic son of man, respectively. Daniel 10, verse 6, his body was also like the beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words likened to the voice of a multitude. Revelation 1, 13 to 15. And in the midst of the seven lampstands, one likened to the Son of Man, clothed with a garment down to the foot, and girt about the paps with a golden girdle. His head and his hairs were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet likened to fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace, and his voice as the sound of many waters. These instances refer not only to Christ, but also to the multitude of saints in their future perfected state, who previously had bodies of sin, but who had straight feet, sure-footed in the word, and through the fiery trial of their faith, were able to overcome. This would lead us to conclude then that this singular individual in Ezekiel chapter 40 is meant to represent Christ. This is bolstered by the fact that this individual not only measures the various portions of the house for Ezekiel to record, but is also noted in later verses to be the one who makes or builds the house. And we'll see that when we see verse 14 here in chapter 40. Thus, this man could be said to be the chief architect of the temple, this man of brass. Zechariah 6, 12 and 13 states, "Behold, the man whose name is the branch, he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit and rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne, and the council of peace shall be between them both," that is, between the kingly side and the priestly side. We also see this man with a measuring line and a reed. While these are indeed instruments of measure, as they are used to specify the size of the sanctuary to Ezekiel, they are also symbols of a ruler. The measuring line symbolizing the measuring out of judgments, and the reed being a rod or scepter denoting rulership. So first, here are some examples of a measuring line. Remember, he had that line of flax in his hand. A measuring line being used for judgment. 2 Kings 21, 11 to 13. "Because Manasseh, king of Judah, hath done these abominations, and hath done wickedly above all that the Amorites did, which were before him, and hath made Judah also to sin with his idols. Therefore thus saith Yahweh Elohim of Israel, behold, I am bringing such evil upon Jerusalem and Judah, that whosoever heareth of it, both his ears shall tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the line of Samaria, and the plummet of the house of Jacob," that is, those things that already happened to Israel, or rather to Samaria and to the house of Ahab. "And I will wipe Jerusalem as a man wipeth a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down." Lamentations 2, 7 and 8. "The Lord hath cast off his altar, he hath abhorred his sanctuary. He hath given up into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces. They have made a noise in the house of Yahweh as in the day of a solemn feast. Yahweh hath purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He hath stretched out a line. He hath not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore he made the rampart and the wall to lament. They languished together. So again, the stretching out of the line being associated with his hand destroying. Isaiah 28:16-19. Therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh, behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to the plummet. And the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place, and your covenant with death shall be disannulled. And your agreement with the grave shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then you shall be trodden down by it. To quote from Brother Sully's work, The Temple of Ezekiel's Prophecy, Jesus is the center of the new system. He will then, as it were, hold in his hand those saints who rule with him, and they will be a line by which affairs of state will be ministered in perfection. What of the reed? We already noted the use of the reed as a rod or scepter. Genesis 49:8-10. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah's lion's well. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rise him up? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh, which means peace, and we think of the Prince of Peace there, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So thinking of those gathering together from year to year to keep the Feast of Tabernacles in the kingdom age. Numbers 24:17-19. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also shall be a possession for his enemies, and Israel shall do valiantly. Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion, and shall destroy him that remaineth of the city. The Psalms, chapter 2, verses 6-9. Yet have I set my king upon mine holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree. Yahweh hath said unto me, thou art my son, and this day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thy inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Psalm 110:1-2. Yahweh said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Yahweh shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Where is this man with his man of brass with his measuring reed and his line of flax? He's standing in Zion. Yahweh shall set the rod of thy strength out of Zion. Rule thou in the midst of thine enemies. Two more verses. Isaiah 11, verses 1 and verse 4. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Verse 4. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, or his words, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. In Hebrews 1:8-9, and this is a quote from Psalm 45. But unto the Son he saith, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, hath anointed thee with the oil of gladness above thy fellows. Before we get to this slide here, one final point on this man's description, this man of brass. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 3 states, and he stood in the gate. This would have been a notable and very positive visual for Ezekiel, given what was written regarding Israel back in chapter 22. So let's go read that. Chapter 22, verses 23-31. Of course, Ezekiel receives this vision while he's in captivity. Ezekiel 22, verses 23 through the end. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, say unto her, thou art the land that is not cleansed, nor rained upon in the day of indignation. There is conspiracy of her prophets in the midst thereof. Like a roaring lion ravening the prey, they have devoured lives. They have taken the treasure and precious things. They have made her many widows in the midst thereof. Her priests have violated my law, and have profaned my holy things, and have put no difference between the holy and the profane. Neither have they showed a difference between the unclean and the clean, and have hid their eyes from my Sabbaths, and I am profaned among them. For princes in the midst thereof are like wolves ravening the prey, to shed blood and to destroy lives, to get dishonest gain. And our prophets have daubed them with untempered mortar, seeing vanity and divining lies unto them, saying, Thus saith the Lord God, when Yahweh hath not spoken. The people of the land have used oppression and exercised robbery, and have vexed the poor and needy. Yea, they have oppressed the stranger wrongfully. And I sought for a man among them that should make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it, and I found none. Therefore have I poured out mine indignation upon them, and I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. Their own way have I recompensed upon their heads, saith Adonai Yahweh. He searched for a man to stand in the gap, and he would not build with untempered mortar. Let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 40 and read verse 3 again as comparison. It's what Ezekiel sees here in this vision. And he brought me thither, and behold, there was a man, whose appearance was like the appearance of brass, and a line of flax in his hand, and a measuring reed, and he stood in the gate. So here in the future, you do have a man standing in this gap, or this gate, right at the edge of the holy and the profane. Let me catch up my notes here. All right, so we compare this. So what a momentous change of circumstances for Israel and for Zion that Ezekiel sees, and for the whole world, for that matter. As Ezekiel approached this man, he was told in verse 4, Son of man, behold with thine eyes, and hear with thine ears, and set thine heart upon all that I shall show thee. For to the intent that I might show them unto thee art thou brought hither. Declare all that thou seest to the house of Israel. And certainly Ezekiel did set his heart upon it. And how could you not, given again what we just read in chapter 20? And what we'd like to do in the remainder of our study, then, is like Ezekiel, to set our heart upon it. And we would like to consider the relative layout, size, and then, most importantly, the function of the various portions of this temple complex. And this will take many talks. We're obviously not going to cover all that today. Some of this we've mentioned in a general fashion in previous exhortations. But in order to get a full mental picture of the grandeur of this house of prayer, we do need to look at the measurements and the specifications that are reported for us in Scripture. For the remainder of our exhortation today, we'll be focusing simply on the measure of the outside wall, the outer and inner gate structures, and the corner courts or towers. And we're not going to go into all the intricacies of that, but just the overall measure. I should have just read this out of my notes. We won't have time to cover all the intricacies and functions of these structures today, but this should give us a good foundation to start from. One thing that is helpful is that once the description of the outer gate structure is given in these next verses that we're going to look at, the same measure is referenced continually for all the inner and outer gate buildings on each side. And of course, that does have a few extra details on various sides added in later regarding some of the furniture that's used and other particulars, which are not mentioned in these first set of verses. All right, let's read Ezekiel 40, verse 5 to begin. And behold, a wall on the outside of the house round about, and in the man's hand a measuring reed of 6 cubits long by the cubit and a handbreadth, so he measured the breadth of the building, 1 reed, and the height, 1 reed. The first thing Ezekiel sees is a wall of separation on the outside of the house round about. I've tried to, hopefully it shows up on the screen here, I've tried to put a red line around what he's looking at. This is the extent of the frame of a city that he saw from a distance. Here we're told that the breadth or depth of the wall is measured 1 reed, and the height of the wall is measured 1 reed. The length of the wall on all four sides is measured at 500 reeds over in chapter 42, turn there quickly. Ezekiel 42, 16 to 20. Ezekiel 42, verse 16. He measured the east side with a measuring reed, 500 reeds, with a measuring reed round about. And he measured the north side, 500 reeds, with a measuring reed round about. And he measured the south side, 500 reeds, with a measuring reed. And he turned about to the west side and measured 500 reeds, and with the measuring reed. He measured it by the four sides. It had a wall round about, 500 reeds long and 500 broad, to make a separation between the sanctuary and the profane place. Remember the verses we read back in Ezekiel 20, they made no difference at that point between the holy and the profane, but here you have this wall of separation. Okay, so again, this wall forms a separation between the sanctuary, which includes everything within the structure, and the profane, or everything outside of the structure. Now, thankfully, we're given a more specific measure of the reed in verse 5 of chapter 40, which we'll get here. The reed in the man's hand is equal to 6 cubits, and the cubit is specified as the cubit and a hand's breadth, also known as the royal cubit. A Hebrew cubit in ancient times was measured from the elbow to the end of the longest finger. Here, an additional hand breadth was added on top of that, and most historians place this form of the cubit, that is the royal cubit, as somewhere between 21 and 24 inches in length. So pictured here is a depiction of the Egyptian royal cubit, which was measured in the same way. They had a slightly different measure. Historians that think the Egyptian cubit was slightly longer. For the purpose of this presentation, we'll be using 24 inches or 2 feet per cubit. For the royal cubit, simply because that's what Brother Sully most often references throughout his book. And it's also easier for me, anyway, to calculate in my mind, since 2 feet per cubit, you can just double the amount of cubits you read and you know how long it is. But regardless of what number is chosen, you still end up with an enormous structure. Whether it's 21 or 24, it's still mind-bogglingly large. Considering this wall, then, back to this, which we'll find later acts as a foundation for massive pillars that we find on either side, on each side rather, of the sanctuary, we find that this is 1 reed tall, that is 6 cubits or 12 feet high. It is 1 reed thick, so 12 feet thick of solid rock, and 500 reeds in length on each side. That amounts to 3,000 cubits or 6,000 feet. This means that each side is just over and 1 1/8 of a mile, just over 1 1/8 of a mile for each side. Thus, the area within the sanctuary, including the wall itself, comprises about 36 million square feet. If it was a complete flat plain, it would be 36 million square feet, or 826 acres. Now, the actual usable square footage will exceed that number due to the fact that the various buildings, which we'll find in the sanctuary, have multiple levels. But still, it's already, again, an unfathomable size to wrap your mind around, just in terms of sheer size. Now, an endless wall would not be of much use for a place of worship. You'd have no way to get in. And indeed, we see that the brazen man stands in the gate, or entrance, through which one can enter the sanctuary. We typically think of a city gate, at least in ancient times, as a cutout in an outer wall with bars or doors that can be opened and shut. And certainly that is the case here, as we'll see that there are doors to the gate. In fact, the word for gate is sha'ar, S-H-A-A-R, meaning to split or open. So you have this idea of dividing up the wall into sections. However, as we go through the measurements here, we find that these gates may be more properly understood as an entry hall or an atrium building, whichever one gives you the correct picture there. And you can kind of see that here on the screen. An entry hall or an atrium building through which Ezekiel walks with doors on each end. Further, in verse 18 of chapter 40, during the description of the outer court, it notes that there are gates, plural, along the length of the court, indicating that there is more than one gate per side. Here's just something to give you an idea of that. We won't get into it today, but Brother Sully presents some fairly convincing mathematical proofs based on the measurements given, that there are likely 11 gates on each side, separating each side into 12 sections. So if you looked at one side, you would see 10 cella buildings. So he uses a term cella in the singular, cellae in the plural. That's actually a word borrowed from Roman and Greek architecture and describes interior chambers usually surrounded by columned buildings. So if you've ever seen the Parthenon, for instance, it has a lot of columns on the outside and has a building on the inside. It's called a cella. In any case, that's the word he uses for these large chambers and buildings in between each of the gates. So again, 11 gates, which are noted by the green lines on the slide, and I included both the outer and inner gates just to make it easier to see the division there, separating each side into 12 sections, 10 cella buildings and 2 corner towers. So no matter which side you looked at, you'd likely see 12 sections. In any case, let's begin going through the dimensions listed here for the Eastern Gate in verses 6 through 16 of Ezekiel 40. And we're going to do so with the help of these visuals that we have on the screen so that we're aware of what is being measured. So first off, and just as an aside on the slide, you're looking straight down at a cutout of the gate with the outside at the bottom. As you go towards the inside, towards the top, you're traveling inwards towards the temple. So first off, in verses 6 through 9, the man begins measuring the complete depth of the gate building from the outside inward by measuring each individual section. We find in verse 15 that the total depth should be 50 cubits in all, which is about 100 feet. So we're going to see if that adds up. First, Ezekiel 40, verse 6. Then he came unto the gate which looks towards the east, and went up the stairs thereof. We find out in verse 22 and 26 that there are specifically 7 steps to each gate. And you can see those counted on the bottom of the slide with 7 circles. Hopefully you can see them down there on the bottom. The last step being even with the floor of the entry hall. Continuing. And he measured the threshold of the gate, which was 1 reed broad, and the other threshold of the gate, which was 1 reed broad. So here we have 2 thresholds mentioned, each one measuring 1 reed in depth, which is the same as the measure of the depth of the wall, 1 reed or 6 cubits. Verse 7. And every little chamber was 1 reed long and 1 reed broad. We find out in verse 10 that there are 3 little chambers on each side, each one having a 1 reed by 1 reed cross section. These little chambers are likely meant as lifts between the various floors of the building. We'll discuss the reasoning behind that interpretation in one of our next talks. Continuing in verse 7, and between the little chambers were 5 cubits. This would indicate 2 sections of 5 cubits between the 3 little chambers on each side of the entry hall. Verse 10 indicates that there will be posts or pillars in these areas, which we'll find will support the archways that span the length of the building. So if you look on the screen here, we see the letter E on those structures that are black with a little circle there with E. That's where the pedestals are on which the pillars stand. Mm-hmm. Yeah. See. Just got a laser pointer. That's cool. All right. So right here, so these would be where pillars are. There's also going to be pillars on here as well as on here. So again, you've got the 2 thresholds. You've got 3 little chambers, which we'll find out later in later verses, which are each 6 by 6. And then you have these spaces between the little chambers of 5 cubits, which we'll later find out these spaces are where the posts go. All right, thank you for that. All right, continuing. And the threshold of the gate by the porch of the gate was 1 reed. Verse 8, he measured also the porch of the gate within 1 reed. This can be a little bit confusing. In short, we again have 2 thresholds of 1 reed depth, again 6 cubits, just as we had on the opposite end of the entry hall. However, as this area is covered over, it is more properly considered a porch. Quoting from Brother Sully's work, quote, a similar space on the exit side of the gateway could not be quite so appropriately called a threshold, a term usually associated with an entrance. Yet this space would serve the same purpose as the threshold adjoining it, that is, for receiving the swing of the doors of exit. So if you look here on the top, he actually has little drawings of the doors, which then swing inwards on each side. So just as you had two thresholds down here at the bottom, you have two thresholds at the top. Let's see here. Thus, the fourth space of six cubits, so he's counted 1, 2, 3, 4. The fourth space of the six cubits at the inner gate of the gateway is described as a porch. The word translated porch is elam, E-L-A-M, signifying fitted or joined into one another, a vault or an arch. All that is necessary to form a threshold into a porch is to roof it over with a lintel. The side jambs thus joined together become a porch, thus taking porch to mean a covered threshold. The architectural requirements are satisfied, and I took his word for it on that one. And certainly it makes sense, again, geometrically speaking. And as we add all these things up, we'll find that, at least in terms of the numbers, they do add up to 50. We're continuing into verse 9. Then measured he the porch of the gate, 8 cubits, and the post thereof, 2 cubits. And the porch of the gate was inward. Thus a porch extended towards the outer court, away from the gate for 8 cubits, plus an extra 2 cubits for the posts, or 10 cubits in total. Again, to quote from Brother Sully, the porch is stated to be inward, that is to say, it stands clear of the gate building and is inside the court. From the order in which the measurements are given, the two porches appear to adjoin each other. He's talking about the porches here and then the larger porches on this part right here. As shown in plate 5, the two form a sort of inner and outer porch, 1 6 cubits wide, within the main structure of the gate building on the side of the doors, and the other with the post projecting 10 cubits into the outer court. So he's basically saying the porch really contains this entire area. This would be the inner, and this would be the porch at the gate, or inside the gate, rather. Just for another visual of the outer portion of this porch, let's look at another slide here. This is looking at a side view. You have on the, if you were coming into the temple, you would come in on the left. You travel through the gate building, out into the outer court, through the inner gate building. If you were a political priest, you could enter that building, and then into the inner court on the far right. So this shows, again, the porches of both the outer gate on the left and the inner gate on the right. Both extend towards each other in the open pavement in between. So each of these buildings has a porch that extends into the outer court. So you have one right here, and one right here, right, where it has the measure of 10 cubits on the screen. Getting back to our measurements here, then, if we count these individual measures moving from the outside inward, so from the bottom to the top on the slide here, you have 6 cubits for the threshold, 6 for a little chamber, 5 cubits between, 6 for another chamber, 5 cubits between, 6 cubits for the final little chamber, 6 cubits for the threshold, and then 10 cubits for the porch of the gate, which again includes the 8 cubits for the porch and the 2 cubits for the post. In total, 50 cubits, or 100 feet, matching the complete measure of the face of the from the face of the gate, which I have underlined right here, the face of the gate on the absolute outside of the sanctuary to the face of the porch, which is the fullest extent of the porch up here. So from here to here, 50 cubits. Now the man turns and makes additional measurements. In verse 10, Ezekiel 40, verse 10, and the little chambers, this is verse 11 rather, first verse 10, the little chambers of the gate eastward were 3 on this side, 3 on that side, and they 3 were of one measure, and the post had one measure on this side and that side. So we already covered this previously, noting that there were 6 little chambers in total. But here we get the additional detail in this verse that the area between the little chambers had the posts of equal size that we mentioned. We'll see later that, again, the width of these posts will actually match the width of the arches that go over this gate building. All right, sorry about that. So continuing in Ezekiel 40, verse 11. And he measured the breadth of the entry gate. Excuse me. And he measured the breadth of the entry gate, 10 cubits, and the length of the gate, 13 cubits. Here we see that the entry gate was 10 cubits wide. Given that there are 2 separate thresholds, there are then 2 10-cubit wide gates. Also, the length of the gate is in reference to its height, seeing as a 13-cubit depth or thickness would not be possible for a door. This certainly provides an impressive and an efficient means of entry and exit to and from the sanctuary. Assuming a two-leaves door for each threshold, each of the four doors would be 5 cubits wide and 13 cubits tall. That is 10 feet wide and 26 feet high. So you would have four doors, and total would be 20 by 13 if you included all four here. So on the right on the screen here, I've shown what one of those sets of doors might look like on the right in terms of just the shape, that is. All right, next. Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 12. The space also before the little chambers was 1 cubit on this side, and the space was 1 cubit on that side. And the little chambers were 6 cubits on this side and 6 cubits on that side. We noted earlier that there were a total of 6 little chambers, 3 on each side, which were 6 by 6 cubits apiece. This adds the detail that these chambers have a 1 cubit space before or in front of each chamber on either side of the chamber. This effectively offsets the little chambers by 1 cubit from the interior walls of the entry hall and the cella building. So I've shown them here. I just he had already had them colored in, but just to bring your eye to it, I put little red rectangles over each of these 1 cubit spaces before each of these little chambers. Next, verse 13. He measured then the gate from the roof of one little chamber to the roof of the other. The breadth was 20 and 5 cubits, door against door. Here's the measure of the full width of the entry hall. It is in considering this full width, we have already seen the two sets of 10 cubit wide gates, totaling 20 cubits across. So again, you would have 10 here, 10 there. At the top, it would be the same. And he actually has it written here. You have 10 cubits and 10 cubits. That's 20. Added to that, you have the two 1-cubit spaces that we just looked at before each little chamber, totaling 22 cubits across. And this leaves 3 cubits remaining. So what do we make of these extra 3 cubits? Brother Sully suggests that if the doors of the gate are, in fact, of a two-leaf arrangement, then two of the doors would swing inwards toward the center of the entry hall. And you can see his sketches of this at the top of the slide, where he has this black line right here. You've got the door right here would swing in towards the center. This door also would swing towards the center. The ones on the outside would swing towards the outer walls. These doors, these inner ones, would have to be secured to a lintel, in addition to possibly the floor and the ceiling for support. Remember the size of these doors being 10 feet wide by 26 feet tall. So that's quite a bit of door to move, and you would need something to be able to support that. The lintel would then bisect the entry hall into two distinct sections. He notes that the width of the doors are not specified in Ezekiel, that is, the thickness of them, are not specified in Ezekiel, but that if they were 1 cubit thick each, that would provide for a 1 cubit wide lintel at the center against which the two doors would fold when opened, thus creating a 3 cubit wide division in the center of the room. And on the other hand, if the doors end up being thinner than that, that just means you have a much larger lintel to hold them up. The other doors on the outside when opened would also be flush with the 1 cubit spaces between or before the little chambers on the outside. Thus, in the open position, the total measure, door against door, amounts to 25 cubits. So again, if this door, this thing going, I think our battery's dying on this laser pointer. Sorry, I don't know if I can get the mouse on it or not. That's right. Assuming that the doors were open, again, you would have from here all the way to here would be 25 cubits, door against door. I think this laser pointer's dying. That's okay. Hopefully the visuals will still be useful. All right, Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 14. He made also the posts of 70 cubits, even to the posts of the court round about the gate. This references the posts upon the pedestals between the little chambers, as well as the posts on either side of the gates, standing upon the outer wall and upon the pedestals on the face of the gates towards the porch. Brother Sully spent an entire page and a half in his work explaining how these posts, which are referred to as palm trees in the next verse, indicating their ornamentation as palms, are likely 30 cubits in height rather than 60 cubits apiece, and are likely set upon pedestals of equal height to the top of the gate, which we already learned was 13 cubits high. I'll freely admit I'm not entirely sure I completely followed his explanation here, but his conclusion was that the height of the two columns for each archway, so you have a column with an archway going across and another column, the height of the two columns together equaled 60 cubits, thus 30 cubits apiece. In any case, whether the columns themselves are 60 cubits or 120 feet high, or if the overall structure is that high, including the archways, which, of course, that seems to be Brother Sully's interpretation based on the sketches, both are of a significant proportion to make a visitor feel quite small, which is certainly an appropriate frame of mind to have when approaching Yahweh's sanctuary. So again, based on his sketches, he seems to have it as you have the height of the gate itself being 13. Again, we've measured the doors being 13 cubits high. And then he adds on top of that 30 cubits for the pillar, which the two pillars across from each other together would be 60. And then according to his sketches, that would leave perhaps 17 cubits to the top of the archway, which would still amount in 60 cubits total. He doesn't really specify the height of the arch here, but that seems to be what he's going for. But like I said, regardless of which one you go with, you still would feel quite small walking up to the structure. We covered verse 15 already regarding the full length of the gate building being 50 cubits. So moving on to verse 16. And there were narrow windows with little chambers, and to their posts within the gate round about, and likewise to the arches, and windows were round about inward, and upon each post were palm trees. Here we are introduced to two final aspects of the entry halls that we'll see repeated throughout the architecture of the outer and inner gate structures: windows and arches. We'll discuss the windows in more detail next time, but as a short preview, the Hebrew word is chalon or chalon, C-H-A-L-L-O-N, meaning a window as perforated. A window as perforated, and implies a lattice work or an arabesque. And we'll have some examples of those next time. You can see Brother Sully's interpretation on the far left there, including some climbing plants among the lattice. The final measure of the gate that we'll look at today is regarding these archways, which are measured in verse 30 as 25 cubits in length for a cross and 5 cubits broad or thick. These match up to the exact measurements of the width of the gate building given in verse 13, as well as to the exact thickness of the pedestals between the little chambers given in verse 7, which again, you can see that on the right. So on the left, of course, you have the width being measured here of the arches. On the right, earlier, we had the 25 going across that as well. But again, these 5 cubit wide spaces between the little chambers are the same width as these archways of which are measured in verse 30. Also in that sketch on the right, the darker pinkish color that you see going across there indicates an area over which an archway extends. So he suggests, that is, Brother Sully suggests, that 4 archways would be for the atrium of the entry hall, with these archways then continuing in each direction until you reach the corner court buildings. So the archways just keep on continuing until you reach the corner buildings, which we'll talk about here in a moment. For today, I have 2 final measurements to make note of to complete our picture of at least the general expanse of the outer buildings. First is regarding the outer court. In verses 19, 23, and 27, and I probably should have said this earlier, as you go through this chapter, he starts on the east, but then he continues, he goes to the north and to the south, and it keeps on repeating over and over, they're of the same measure, of the same measure, and so forth. So in verses 19, 23, and 27 of this chapter, the outer court is measured on the east, north, and south sides of the sanctuary from the face of the interior gates of the outer and inner gate buildings as 100 cubits. That was a lot of words put together. This measure would then include the 10-foot porch of the gate on each side, given that the gates themselves, or the doorways themselves, are specified as the endpoints of these measures. So here on the screen, you can see that 100 measure going across. from the interior gates of the outer gate and the inner gate. So the inner gate structure is the one on the right. The outer gate structure is the one on the left. The outer court goes directly down the center. So it's measuring the full extent of the outer court, including those two porchways. Given then that the gate buildings of the outer and inner gates are of identical proportions, 50 cubits in depth, and subtracting out the 10 cubits of the porch of the gates on each side, you end up with a total depth from the outer wall on the far left to the innermost gate on the far right of 180 cubits. So that would be the entirety of this length would be 180 cubits. Now, why did we spend the time to specifically measure that out? The reasoning is that it helps us solidify our understanding of the measure of the four corner buildings, which we'll look at briefly in chapter 46, 19 through 24. So you can go ahead and turn that up. Chapter 46, 19 to 24. And I'm going to put up Brother Sully's rendition of this, as it includes some corrections to what we see in the KJV. The corrections, or his suggested corrections, will be in italics, so you can compare. And while he notes several revisions, today we're just going to be focusing on the measurement in verse 22. So here on the screen will be Brother Sully's version of this. Then he brought me through the entry, which is at the side of the gate, into the holy cella, or cellae. So again, that's the word he uses for these various structures between the gates. Into the holy cellae for the priest, which looked towards the north, and behold, there is a place on the hinder part westward. If you remember the of all the temple and tabernacles and so forth, the east was the front, the west then would be the hinder or the back part. Then he said unto me, this is the place where the priests boil the trespass offerings and the sin offering, where they shall bake the meal offering, that they bear them not out into the outer court to sanctify the people. Then he brought me forth into the outer court and caused me to pass by the four corners of the court. So he's walked around the entire length of this this building through the outer court. And behold, a court in every corner of the court. So this court building is found on each corner of the outer court. In the four corners of the court are courts smoking, 40 reeds long and 30 broad, one measure to their four corners. And a row round about to them four, in a row round about to the four of them, and made with boiling places under the rows round about. Then he said unto me, these are the places of them that boil, where the ministers of the house shall boil the sacrifice to the people. So you already get a little bit of a hint of the activities that will be occurring in these corner towers. And I call them towers because of what we're going to see here regarding verse 22 in the measure. Specifically, you'll note that in verse 22, that the Authorized Version inserts the word cubits in italics. Here, Brother Sully changes that to reeds and notes, quote, in verse 22, reeds are substituted for cubits because the word cubit is not in the original and has been inserted by the translator for no apparent reason. The measure of the house is the reed. My little note here, that's what the man of brass held in his hand. He held the measuring reed. The measure of the house is the reed, and the courts are said to be of one measure. Therefore, each side of the square is 30 measures or 30 reeds broad and 40 measures or 40 reeds high, thus forming a court 30 reeds, or 180 cubits, square, whose superstructure rises 40 reeds, or 240 cubits, high. Thus we find that the corner courts, as they are called, are the exact width on each side as the full breadth of the outer gate, outer court, and inner gate combined, 180 cubits, or perhaps 360 feet. These corner courts, then, are of sufficient size to form a perfect square, along with the gate buildings, as well as sufficient bulk to handle the lateral loads produced by the archways of the gate buildings, which proceed outward in two directions from each corner court. So if you look at each of the corners there, you have two sets of gate buildings going outward from each one of them. So these are massive structures, and you can see on the right the comparison between the gate buildings on the left of that right picture, that the part that actually makes it seem kind of small compared to the corner towers and the amount of weight those corner towers have to be able to withstand the lateral loads from the archways. And we'll speak about that next time as to why that's important. To conclude for today, we'd like to have one final quote from Brother Sully, followed by a reading from Psalm 48. Having described the height and breadth of the corner courts to be 480 feet high and 360 feet broad, Brother Sully has the following to say. The top of the Statue of Liberty upon the dome of the Capitol at Washington is said to be 307 feet above the ground, and the monument erected to the memory of General Washington, 553 feet high and 55 feet square at the base. But the Washington Monument is a mere stick by comparison with the towers specified for the Temple of Yahweh's Glory. This last example, if it were 360 feet square, that is talking about the Washington Monument, if it were 360 feet square, or about 42 times larger in area, would then be approximate to the enormous bulk of the towers specified in Ezekiel. You'll note here that, you know, Brother Sully added some embellishments to the top of the corner court, which would just about match the height of the Washington Monument. I just kind of found that amusing that he added that, because if you measure it on the left-hand side, you have to measure 240 cubits. It stops just shy of the top, and he has some decorations there on top. So I don't know if he did that on purpose or not. But in any case, it almost meets the height of the Washington Monument, but in area, it dwarfs that building. Continuing the quote, speaking from an architectural point of view, the temple towers seem but a necessary adjunct to the building of which they form a part. It has been stated that ancient architects strove to obtain effect by the length of their facade or frontage, while the moderns endeavor to impress the observer by the height of their buildings. In the temple of the age to come, when the Son of God builds the temple of universal worship, all previous structures will dwindle into insignificance by comparison. A building whose facade is over 1 mile long, whose towers are 360 feet square and 480 feet high, whose outermost buildings are a double range of magnificent rooms, which we haven't looked at those yet, those are the cellae he talks about, of magnificent rooms, each 100 feet long by 50 feet wide, and perhaps 120 feet high in their several stories. This is far, far greater in magnificence than anything the world has ever seen, either in ancient or modern times. A building such as that specified in Ezekiel cannot be adequately described. Words fail to convey a due sense of its magnitude, but the Spirit of God and the prophets has indicated the wonder of its immensity. So we'd like to close by reading from Psalm 48, verses 9 to 14. Psalm 48, 9 to 14. We have thought of thy loving kindnesses, O God, of thy loving kindness, O God, in the midst of thy temple. According to thy name, O God, so is thy praise unto the ends of the earth. Thy right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion rejoice. Let the daughters of Judah be glad because of thy judgments. Walk about Zion. Go round about her. Tell the towers thereof. Mark ye well her bulwarks, consider her palaces, that ye may tell it to the generation following. For this God is our God forever and ever. He will be our guide even unto death. We'll stop there in part one of our series. Hopefully next time we'll talk more about some of the functions of these buildings, in addition to the fact of being gate buildings. And then we'll see if we'll be able to get to the inner temple or not. That might have to be in part three. We'll have to see. That's me.